You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. As well, you can hear these podcasts at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. There are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org in America and RudolfSteinerPress.com in England, which are the sole publishers of Steiner into English and have given me permission to do these recordings. Please consider patronizing them as well. This is a reading of Collected Works, Volume 209 by Rudolf Steiner, entitled The Language of the Cosmos. It's 11 lectures given in various cities, translated by Agnes Schneeberg de Stur. This is Lecture 2, given in Christiania, Oslo, on November 27, 1921. We have seen how, in accordance with anthroposophical knowledge, the true nature of the human being must be regarded in relation to the whole universe. To begin with, we considered the form and configuration of the human being. This structure had to be attributed to the fixed stars, or rather to the representative of the fixed stars, the zodiac. We have seen how certain forces emanate from the corresponding star constellations, and when combined with the influence of the sun, how the forces that give form to the human head and the organs connected with it are related to the upper constellations of the zodiac, Aries, Taurus, Gemini, Cancer. We have seen how the forces that determine the form of the human chest organization are related to the middle constellations, Leo, Virgo, Libra, Scorpio. And finally, how the forces that lead to the metabolic limb system are related to the lower constellations, that is to say, to their influences, while they are, in a sense, covered by the earth, to the constellations of Sagittarius, Capricorn, Aquarius, Pisces. And so, in summary, we may say that the whole sphere of the fixed stars, for the zodiacal constellations are only their representatives, works upon the human form and structure. The planetary spheres work upon human life, upon the levels or conditions of life. And indeed, we must make it quite clear to ourselves that there are various forms of life within us. We would not be able to think, and our head would not be an organ of thought, if life in our head were as vigorous as it is, for example, in the metabolic system. When metabolism becomes too strong in the head, our consciousness, our ability to reason, is extinguished. It can be inferred from this, even in an outer sense, that a lowered, suppressed life, a dying life, is necessary for consciousness and for the forming of mental images. On the other hand, an intense, thriving, rampant life is necessary for that which works more out of the unconscious in us, for the will. Accordingly, among the various levels of life within us, we have some that are more of a dying, self-extinguishing kind, and some that are true life levels, comparable to how a strong, intense, organic life develops in a child, in whom thinking is not yet present. We have this childlike life continually within us, but the other life, the life that is progressively dying, inserts itself into this childlike life. These different life levels are regulated by the planetary spheres. Whereas the sphere of the fixed stars works through its physical forces upon the human being, the planetary sphere works through its etheric forces. The planetary sphere, therefore, works upon the human being in a more delicate way. And it is indeed so that the human physical body has received its form, its shape, from the fixed stars, not from anything earthly, and its life levels from the planetary sphere. In this way, we have considered the form of the human physical body and the life levels of the etheric body. We can now proceed to a consideration of the soul life and the spirit life of the human being. However, here our approach must be different. What is it that our physical body and our etheric body provide for us in waking life? They, facilitate what we perceive through our senses and what we can process through our thoughts. For it is only in what our senses perceive and in what we process in our thoughts that we are truly awake. Contrast this with the life of feeling. It will be obvious, even from a merely superficial observation, that feeling does not signify wakefulness in the same sense as thinking and sense perception. When we wake in the morning and encounter the colors and sounds of the outside world, we become aware of the conditions of warmth around us. Our fully awake state appears, and we process in our thoughts what is transmitted by the senses. But when feelings rise up from the soul, it cannot be said that in these feelings we are conscious to the same extent. Feelings are linked and associated with sense perceptions. One sense impression pleases us, another displeases us. Feelings also link themselves with our thoughts. Moreover, anyone who compares the pictures we experience in our dreams with what we experience in our feelings will be well aware of the relationship between the state of dreaming and that of feeling. Dreams must first be grasped by our waking thought life if they are to be evaluated and understood aright. But feelings too must be examined by our thought life, as it were, if we are to find the right connection to them. In our feelings we are actually dreaming. When we dream in pictures. When we are awake, we dream in our feelings. And in our will, we are asleep even when fully awake. Just consider the following. When we raise an arm, when we do something, we know through observation what movements the arm or hand is making. But we do not know how the power of the will is actually functioning in the organism. We know as little about this as we know about the conditions prevailing during sleep. That is, from the time of falling asleep until we wake up. Inasmuch as we will something, inasmuch as we do something, we are asleep, while at the same time we are awake in respect of our sense perceptions and our thoughts. Accordingly, we are not only sleeping from the time we fall asleep until we wake up, we are sleeping in part of our being during waking life too. We are sleeping as regards our will, and we are dreaming as regards our feelings. What we experience during sleep is concealed from our consciousness, but the true nature of our feeling and of our will is also concealed from our consciousness. It is nevertheless important that we also become conscious of what the human being experiences in these unconscious realms, in these realms of which our ordinary life is not conscious. You know from various anthroposophical lectures that from the time of going to sleep until that of waking, the I, capital, and the astral body are outside the physical body and the etheric body. Now it can be especially important to become familiar with those experiences in particular which the I and the astral body undergo from the time of falling asleep to that of waking up. When we are awake, we meet the natural world through our sense perceptions. One could say that with these sense perceptions of nature, we come to a barrier, that with our sense perceptions, with our waking thoughts, we reach no further than the surface of things. Now, someone could, of course, argue that one could get beyond the surface of things, for example, by cutting a piece of wood, perceptible to the senses, and one would then be inside it. This would not be correct, however, for if you slice a piece of wood, you have once again only a surface, and if you cut the two pieces again, you still have merely surfaces. Even if you were to get right to the molecules and atoms, you would again only have surfaces. You would not reach what may be called the inner essence of things, for this true inner essence lies beyond the realm of sense perception. We can think of sense perceptions as a tapestry spread out around us. What lies on this side of the tapestry, we can perceive with our senses. What lies on the other side of the tapestry, we do not perceive with the senses. We are in this sense-perceptible world from the time of waking up until the time of falling asleep. Our soul is filled with the impressions made upon us by this sense-perceptible world. Now, when we enter into sleep, we are no longer on this side of the sense world. For in reality, we are then inside the things. We are then on the other side of this sense tapestry. But human beings living in their earthly consciousness know nothing of this, and dream up all sorts of things presumed to exist beyond the realm of sense perception. They dream up molecules and atoms. But these are only dreams, dreams of the waking consciousness. People invent molecules, atoms, and the like, and believe them to be realities. But take any of the studies describing atoms, even the most recent, the most meticulous ones, and in them you will find nothing more than minute objects described according to the criteria of what everyday consciousness experiences on the surface of things. It is all a fabrication derived from the experiences of waking consciousness on this side of the tapestry of sense perception. But when we fall asleep, we escape from this whole world of the senses and penetrate through to the other side. And whereas on this side we experience the natural world with our senses and our waking thoughts, over on yonder side, from the time of falling asleep until the time of waking, we experience the world of spirit, the spirit world, which we also go through before birth and after death. However, in this phase of human development on earth, we are so constituted that our consciousness is extinguished when we are beyond the world of the senses. Human consciousness is not strong enough to penetrate into this spirit world. But what spiritual science designates as imagination, inspiration, intuition, enables us to have knowledge of what lies on the other side of the sense tapestry. And the first thing we find there is the lowest level of the realm that is called the world of the hierarchies. When we wake from sleep, we are placed into the world where the animals, plants, and minerals, the beings of the three kingdoms of nature, are, which belong to the world of the senses. When we fall asleep, crossing beyond the world of the senses, we are initially transported into the first level of the beings ranked above us, that of the angeloi, or angels. And from the time of falling asleep until waking, we are connected with the being who is allotted to each individual person as his or her angel being, just as we are connected through our eyes and ears with the three kingdoms of nature here in the sense world. Even if at first we are not aware of this connection with the world of the angels, it is nevertheless there. This connection extends as far as into our astral body. If while living in the astral body during sleep, we were to suddenly awaken in our astral body, then we would encounter the world of the angels, that is, initially the angel being who is connected with our own life. In the same way as here in the earthly world, we encounter animals, plants, and minerals. Now, even in the earthly world, in the world of the senses, it is the case that if people are attentive and discipline their thinking, they notice much more than those who are inattentive and observe only in a cursory manner. Accordingly, our connection with the three kingdoms of nature can either be intimate or superficial. And it is the same with the world of spiritual beings. But the conditions are different as regards this world of spiritual beings. Someone whose thoughts are entirely wrapped up in the material world, who has no desire to rise above this world, or to learn to appreciate moral ideals extending beyond the merely utilitarian, who has no desire to experience true human love or to develop a devout reverence for the divine spiritual during waking life, such a person on falling asleep has no forces remaining that would make it possible to come into contact in the right way with his or her angel being. Each time we fall asleep, our angel awaits expectantly, as it were. how much we bring with us into sleep as idealistic feelings, as idealistic thoughts. And the more we bring with us of this nature, the more intimate becomes the contact with our angel while we are asleep. And so, throughout our whole life, our waking life, we gather what we develop in ourselves above and beyond material interests. We gather that which makes the relationship to our angel ever more intimate. Once we pass through the portal of death, anything pertaining to the senses falls away from us. The outer world can no longer make any impressions on us, for this can only be done through our senses, and the senses fall away with the body. And thoughts that are tied only to sense perceptions are extinguished too, for this thinking is contained in the etheric body. The etheric body remains with us only for a few days after death. We see it as it initially is present in the form of a tableau which, under special circumstances, can be known and seen, but which must be seen after death. I have also spoken about this from a different point of view in the public lectures of the last few days. One can see right away that as the etheric body's fabric dissolves into the universe, the ordinary thoughts derived from the sense-perceptible world also depart from us. They do not remain. Everything we have thought throughout our life in relation to utilitarian matters, to circumstances regarding the sense world, what we have thought based on the material world, all this departs from us when we pass through the gate of death. Only what we have cultivated throughout our waking life as idealistic thoughts and feelings, as pure human love, as religious reverence in the truest sense of the word, and have thus united with our angel, this we take with us when we pass through the portal of death. Now, this causes something very important to occur in the time of our further development between death and a new birth. In fact, even during our life on earth, we actually have a relationship with other, even higher, hierarchies. It is therefore correct to say that if we fall asleep and the ideals we have cultivated penetrate through to our angel, this angel being in turn communicates with an archangel, with an archai, and so on. Consequently, we find that our existence is carried forward, as it were, into a rich, abundant world of spirit. But this rich spiritual world has no special significance for us while we are living between birth and death. It is only when this world of the higher hierarchies becomes our environment between death and a new birth that it acquires great significance for us. And the more we have handed over to our angel, as it were, the more can this angel, even after our death, when we are beings of soul and spirit, give us of the conscious life, the conscious soul content coming from the higher hierarchies. One could put it as follows. What our eyes and ears are for us here in the physical world, this is what, for our consciousness between death and rebirth, in the spiritual world, our angel develops, or, actually, with the other beings of the third hierarchy, together with even higher hierarchies, develop through our angel. And the more we have brought to our angel, in the way of idealistic thoughts and feelings, of human love and pious reverence, the more does our consciousness become lighter, the more does it become inwardly radiating. Now, there is a certain time between death and a new birth when the angel has a specific task in connection with us. This angel being must establish an even more intimate relation with the hierarchy of the archangeloi, the archangels, than was formerly the case. I have described the time which the human being undergoes between death and a new birth from the most diverse points of view, where this is certainly possible, most recently in a course of lectures given in Vienna in 1914. Today I will describe this matter from some other viewpoints. When a certain, somewhat lengthy period of time has elapsed after death, an important moment arrives when the angel must, as it were, pass on to the archangel, what he has received from us through our above-characterized idealistic experiences. It is as though the human being were placed before the world of the archangels, who can then receive what this individual has cultivated as soul spiritual experiences of this sort during his or her life, between birth and death. This is where great differences become apparent among human beings dwelling between death and a new birth. In our epoch, there are persons who bring very little with them in the way of idealistic thoughts and feelings, of human love, when the time comes for the angel to pass on to the archangel, for the sake of the continuing evolution of the world, what human beings have carried through the portal of death. The interaction developing in this way between the angeloi and the archangeloi must, under all circumstances, take place. But there is a big difference in how we human beings experience what thus transpires between the angels and the archangels. That is to say, whether we are able to follow it more consciously as a result of our above-mentioned experiences, or whether we only undergo it in a dull, dim state. For this is how it must be experienced by those whose consciousness had been focused only on materialistic contents. Actually, it is not quite correct to say that these experiences are dull or dim. It would perhaps be more accurate to say that these human beings experience this in such a way that they feel continually rejected by a world into which they ought to be received, that they feel continually chilled by a world that ought to welcome them with warmth. For human beings should be received with kindness and sympathy by the world of the archangels at this important point in time. They should be received with warmth. Then they will be led in the right way toward what I have called in one of my mystery plays the midnight hour of existence. Human beings are led in turn by the archangeloi to the realm of the archai. And as we become integrated, as it were, into the realm of the archai, we are simultaneously being integrated with all the higher hierarchies. For it is through the archai that we enter into a relationship with all the higher hierarchies. From this realm, we receive the impulse, the drive, to descend to the earth again, inasmuch as we receive the power to work once again as a soul spiritual being, in what will later be provided as physical matter by the hereditary stream. This midnight hour of existence is the point in the life of the human being between death and a new birth, which is crossed in such a way that before reaching this point, one becomes ever more estranged from earthly existence and gradually grows into the spiritual world. How this unfolds depends on whether one is received with more and more sympathy, in the sense described above, by this spiritual world, drawn into it with greater and greater warmth, or is actually repelled and chilled by it. But when the midnight hour of existence has come to pass, the human being gradually begins to feel a longing, as it were, for life down below, on earth again. And it is then, on the second part of this journey, confronted by the world of the archangels once again. For it is really true that between death and a new birth, human beings first ascend to the world of the angeloi, archangeloi, and archai, then descend again, and after passing through the world of the archai, notably encounter the world of the archangels again. Then there comes again an important point in the life between death and a new birth. If we have carried nothing through the portal of death in the way of idealistic thoughts or feelings, of loving kindness, of true religious reverence, then something of our soul's spiritual nature will have perished, as it were, due to the antipathy and the chilly response coming from the higher world. But if we arrive in the realm of the angels with the right soul spiritual attitude, then we will receive, implanted into our inner soul spiritual nature, the power to work effectively in our subsequent life on earth, the ability to penetrate our body in the right way. If we have not brought along such soul spiritual insights, angels will have to implant, but now in such a way that it works more unconsciously, this longing for earthly life. A very great deal depends upon this process of implanting. For during this process, certain aspects of a person's forthcoming earthly life are determined, namely, into which nation, into which language, into which so-called mother tongue this individual will descend and incarnate. What is determined during this process is whether this urge toward a particular people, toward a particular mother tongue, is implanted in a more inner or in a more outer sense, so that during this descent, a human being either becomes filled with deep and inward love for what will become his or her mother tongue, or enters more automatically into what he or she will later have to express by means of the organs of speech. It makes a great difference how a human being becomes destined for a particular language in his or her next life on earth, whether this happens in the one or in the other way described. If already before this earthly life, that is during the second passage through the realm of the angels, our soul can be permeated inwardly, lovingly, with an inclination toward our mother tongue, then we can assimilate it inwardly, take it in as a part of our very being. We become one with it. Then it becomes a genuine love, becomes a soul love. And as we then grow into our language and ethnicity, this becomes something that is absolutely natural. If, however, we grow into it in the other way, I have called this the more automatic mode, then having descended through birth into our earthly existence, we will arrive on the earth in such a way that we only learn to develop an instinctive, compulsive love of our language. And what we cannot generate inwardly as love, as natural love for our language and ethnicity, this gets then forced out, as it were, from our life. It makes a great difference whether we grow into a nation and into a particular language affiliation with the kind of tranquil, pure love of someone who is inwardly united with folk and language, or whether we grow into a language and nation more automatically and then out of instinct and compulsion, as it were, force out the inner love for folk and language. The former disposition can never manifest in what is called chauvinism, in what is a superficial, aggressive form of patriotism. Rather, the inner soul spiritual love for folk and language, gained as a result of previously experienced ideals and devout reverence, will come to expression naturally and is entirely consistent with true universal human love. A genuine cosmopolitan or global outlook can never be stunted by this type of soul spiritual love for a nation and a language. If, however, we grow into our language more automatically, and if as a result of this we develop through our instincts and compulsions an over-fervid, base, animal-like love of language and nation, then we develop what in reality is a false nationalism, a chauvinistic disposition with its emphatic stance on race and nationality. It is especially important and necessary at the present time to look at what we encounter in the outer world, in the time we spend as human beings between birth and death, from the standpoint of life between death and a new birth. For the way in which we become immersed in an ethnicity and a language, through our being linked to a particular hereditary stream by birth, depends upon how we meet and experience, for the second time, the realm of the archangels. Someone attempting to understand life today from a spiritual viewpoint will have to recognize the importance of what human beings experience between death and a new birth when they come for a second time into the realm of the archangels. Today we can see how all around the world people view their nationality, ethnicity, and language in the wrong way. And much of what has come to pass in the evolution of the Western world, with the catastrophic events of the second decade of the 20th century, can only become comprehensible if it is considered from viewpoints such as these. For if we study the inner aspect of life in the light of anthroposophical spiritual science, then we must recognize that the former lives of many people today were lived in such a way that they became more and more entangled in materialism. You all know that, as a rule, the period between death and a new birth is lengthy. But, and this is especially the case in the current phase of evolution, there are many people who have only had a short time between their last death and their present birth. Already in their previous life on earth, they had cultivated little in the way of human love or idealistic sentiments. Even in their previous earthly life, they were mostly concerned with utilitarian matters. And as a result, the seeds were laid during their second contact with the realm of the angels between death and a new birth for what we see arising today in such an evil form in Western civilization. Accordingly, the human being can only be understood as a spatial being when we recognize that we must go as far as the realm of the fixed stars to trace the origin of the human physical shape, and as far as the planetary spheres to trace the origin of the human life levels. That, as a spatial being, the human being draws the forces working within the body, not only from the earth, but from the whole cosmos. And just as it is necessary to go beyond the earthly realm in order to get insight into the human being as a spatial being, so too is it necessary to go beyond the life between birth and death in order to understand human life on earth in its social and nation-bound aspects. When we study life in its many-fold aspects today, we find that although people are often emphatically calling for freedom, they are in reality inwardly unfree, that there is no free life pulsating through the endeavors that bring about such obvious forces of decline nowadays, that instead instincts and compulsions are pulsating there, causing the misery in social life. And anyone observing these things obviously also will want to understand them. Now, just as there is a second meeting with the realm of the archangels, so is there also at a later time, namely when the human being comes much closer to earthly life again, a more intimate union with the angel being, with the angelos. And as one approaches earthly life again, one is pulled back, pulled out, as it were, from the realm of the archangels. As long as we dwell in the realm of the archangels, our angel is also more strongly bound to this realm. One could say that human beings then live within the higher hierarchies. But as the time spent between death and a new birth runs its course, we come to rely more and more only on the realm of the angels, who then lead us through the world of the elements, through fire, air, water, and earth, to the hereditary stream. For it is this angel being that leads us to physical existence on earth. Our angel can make us into a human being able to act in freedom, out of the depths of our soul spiritual being. As long as all the above-mentioned conditions have been fulfilled through our former earthly life. But if things transpired in such a way that we had to be united with our language and our nation automatically, as described above, then the angel is not in a position to guide us to a life of freedom. Then the individual life also becomes unfree. This lack of freedom shows itself in the following way. If we do not grasp concepts freely, but instead inwardly merely think words, then, although we will still develop an inner consciousness, we will do so only superficially, and as a result will be made unfree, because our whole thinking resolves into words. This is, in fact, a fundamental experience of people today, that their thinking becomes immersed in words. It is not possible to understand earthly life in its historical development, especially in its present state, unless we advance to the life between death and a new birth, to the world of soul and spirit. And so, in order to understand the human form, we must point to the realm of the fixed stars, To understand the human life levels, we must point to the planetary spheres. And to understand the soul spiritual life of human beings, we cannot confine ourselves to the period between birth and death. For as we have seen, this soul spiritual life is rooted in the world of the higher hierarchies. Just as the physical body and the etheric body of the human being belong to the external physical and etheric worlds. Similarly, in order to understand thinking, feeling, and willing correctly, we must not confine ourselves to considering the human being only in relation to the external world of the senses, but also in relation to life between death and a new birth. Thinking, feeling, and willing are the forces through which our soul being initially develops. And our idealistic thoughts, that which was implanted into our thoughts and into our soul being out of idealistic love and piety, carry us through the portal of death. The way in which we have influenced our thoughts, how we have permeated our thinking with an idealistic disposition, this is what leads us in the right way to our first encounter with the archangels, with the archangeloi. But once we have passed through the midnight hour of existence, our thinking fades away, as it were. For it is this thinking which then, after the midnight hour of existence, is remolded and adapted for the next earthly life. And out of this, out of what formerly was our thinking, specific forces are then being formed, which will permeate our physical organs of thinking in the coming earthly life. If you observe the human head and see how forces are working in it, then you will recognize that these are not just the forces that are active in this life. These are the forces that stem from the thinking of a previous life, and now give rise to the structure and form of the brain. In contrast, it is notably the will which, during the second meeting with the archangels, plays its own special role in the soul spiritual life of the human being. And it is this will which, then, in the next life on earth, takes hold of the metabolic limb organism in particular. When we then enter through birth into earthly life, the will becomes the factor that makes us either well suited or less suited for certain functions, as far as the metabolic limb organism is concerned. One could say, then, that within our head we have a physical reflection of what we have developed in our previous life as thoughts, that in the abilities of the metabolic limb organism we see the activity of the newly acquired forces of will, which, during the second meeting with the archangel, are incorporated into us either in an inner soul spiritual way, as described earlier, or more, in quotes, automatically. If we see how contemporary life, which leads to the above identified forces of deterioration, specifically for people in the Western world, has evolved, then we will look with the greatest ideal-filled interest at what was taking place in human beings between death and a new birth, during the life preceding this present earthly life. And what can be recognized in this respect will then give us, now that the consequences of materialism are manifesting in the life of the nations, the strong impulse to provide human beings who were already too materialistically inclined in their last incarnation with the kind of motivation that can lead once again to a deepening of the inner life, to freedom, to a true inner and therefore natural connection to language and ethnicity, a connection that does not in any way contradict internationalism or cosmopolitanism. This, however, can only be achieved if our thinking can be set aglow by true spirituality. What does the spirit actually amount to for modern human beings? Thoughts. Thoughts about something. When people today speak of their spirit, they are actually speaking only of their thoughts, of their thinking, which is either fairly abstract or less so. What we need, though, is true spirit, the living spirit penetrating into our inner being. Anthroposophy is really about this living spirit, in the way it views the world that lies between death and a new birth. What we need today, therefore, is that we regard ourselves in respect of our human form, our life levels, our soul spiritual nature, as belonging to a world that lies outside the earthly sphere. Then we will be able to bring the right things into earthly life. We have all experienced how the spiritual essence of human beings is gradually sucked up by various aspects of earthly existence, by political life, by economic life. What is needed is a proclivity, an affinity for an independent spiritual life. This alone can provide the basis for the human being to be imbued with real spirituality, with spiritual substance, not merely with thoughts about one thing or another. This is why Anthroposophy must be willing to work toward a freeing of the spiritual life. If this spiritual life does not create its own firm foundations, then human beings will be living more and more in abstractions. Then they will not be able to permeate themselves with a living spirit, but only with the spirit of abstractions. When here in physical life we pass through the portal of death, our physical corpse is committed to the earth, or to the elements. Our true essential being is no longer within us, our physical corpse. When we pass through birth in such a way that through the processes described, our relation to nation, language, and to our own conduct has become more, in quotes, automatic. Then, when we are born into the physical world, our living thinking, our living impulses of will, our living soul spiritual nature die away. And what then emerges is a corpse of the divine soul spiritual human being within the realm of physical existence. Our abstract rationalistic thinking does indeed hold the corpse of the soul spiritual. Just as the true human being is no longer within the discarded physical corpse, so do we actually have something like a corpse within a thinking that is abstract, within a soul life that is not imbued with spirit, a corpse of the divine spiritual world. Today, humanity really stands at a pivotal, decisive point where it must resolve to accept the spiritual world again, so that the human being can once again penetrate that which has become more or less like a divine spiritual corpse within the abstract thinking of humanity, that which has yielded once more to instincts, compulsions, and automatism. And so you can see the profound inner truth of what I said at the end of yesterday's lecture to the students here. What is needed today if we are to go forward from a decline to a real ascent is that human beings overcome the abstractions, the corpse-like elements in the soul, for this is what they may be called, that are prevalent in the intellectualistic and rationalistic thinking of today. What is needed is a kind of reawakening of the soul spiritual. That such a soul spiritual awakening is indeed a necessity can be seen from the way our social life manifests, both historically and in its present form. If we understand Anthroposophy in a correct and unbiased manner, then we realize that it has a task to fulfill with respect to the human being. It has an eternal task with respect to the enduring principle in human beings that must continue throughout all ages. But it also has a current task in the present age. It must bring human beings back from superficiality, from lameness, from having the divine spiritual life within them dying off. Anthroposophy must bring back this divine spiritual life, inasmuch as we must learn to regard ourselves not merely as earthly, but as heavenly beings, inasmuch as we learn that our earthly life can only be lived in the right way if the forces of heavenly existence, of the existence between death and a new birth, are carried over into this earthly life. We will continue these observations next time in order to bring them to a certain conclusion during these days, which I am able to spend in your midst in a way that is most gratifying for me. The end of Lecture 2.